This is Dr. Allison Bailey, FACC and Chair of the Cardiovascular Management Section Leadership Council at the American College of Cardiology. The CV Management Section is pleased to host the podcast series Practice Made Perfect, which will focus on non-clinical competencies related to leadership skills, professional identity, operational skills, and personal balance. We hope you'll join us every other week as we learn from experts in the field who will remind us that practice makes perfect.
Thanks for joining us on Practice Made Perfect today. We're talking more about understanding medical liability and your risk. I'd like to welcome back Dr. Michael Valentine and Kathy Beagle onto the podcast today. I'm sure all of you have already listened to the first podcast, but if you haven't, please go back and listen to it. But Dr. Valentine is a former president of the ACC and really helped start this podcast series. He has a long history of being involved in the practical aspects of cardiology and leadership, in addition to being a busy practicing cardiology at the Strubitz Cardiovascular Center in Lynchburg, Virginia. Mike, welcome back.
Thank you, Allison.
Of course, Kathy Beagle, who knows everything about the practice of cardiology, is joining us as well. Kathy serves as the president and CEO of Cardiovascular Management of Illinois. She's also chairman of the Board of Managers for MedAxiom and a trustee of the ACC. Kathy, thanks for coming back.
Hey, thanks, Allison. Your flattery will get you anywhere. So it's really because of the great team at MedAxiom and ACC where I've learned just about everything there is about cardiology. And I'm very excited today to sort of go through and kind of what I refer to as peeling the onion back on medical liability. Our first podcast really was a how-to, hopefully gave some actual tips of the trade. But now, Mike, I think it's really important to help people understand contractually and statewide what's really important for not only our FITs, but our early career and our seasoned physicians with boots on the ground, especially in this area of employment. What do you think is important for our members to understand about medical liability?
Well, I think the important thing to understand is that the ACC has a role in this for you, and we'll go over that at the end of this. But I think it's important for our members to know that ACC considers this very important and that we want to leave assets available for our members to be able to search and find help here, Kathy, because this is an area of great concern. And, you know, you have served on our medical liability task force and have worked very closely with us. So I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions here, and we'll start off with the basics. Number one would be, Kathy, what is malpractice insurance and why do I need it?
Yeah, so malpractice insurance is basically referred to as a safety net. It is a cost that each physician needs to have as part of their toolkit in order to protect them in the event of a lawsuit. Notice I didn't say to protect them in case of an adverse event, because that's really not what this is about. Our first podcast explained that there are sometimes adverse events, but how we handle them can oftentimes mitigate the need or the reliance on malpractice. I think the other important thing is because we have such a diverse audience in our podcast, both our employed physicians, our academic physicians, and our independent physicians. And I'm going to speak for a moment to our independent physicians because getting the right malpractice insurance is critical from a cost perspective and from a coverage perspective. And that's why ACC has this relationship with the doctor's company because they do such a great job with our physicians to make sure they're as protected as can be. So if we just simply refer to it's an insurance vehicle, not too dissimilar from your life insurance and your disability insurance. So number one is you need to have it. But the key, Mike, is what kind of insurance? Because there's many different kinds. Do people know that?
I don't think so, Kathy. If you're an independent physician, do you have to have your own insurance through a company? And does your group practice have to go through that?
I think that's a very, very good question. So we'll do independents first because I think they have probably the more complex path. And not only do you need malpractice insurance for yourself, you need it for your group. Because you have to understand that oftentimes attorneys will go after multiple people. People sometimes refer to that as a shotgun lawsuit. If you're a solo practitioner, that's okay, but your corporation can also be sued. So you want your malpractice insurance for both yourself and your corporation. And then you want to start looking at the different elements of it. So why don't we talk about the different elements? So there's probably two main types of insurance. There's what is called occurrence-based and claims-made.
Tell me occurrence-based versus claims-made. Are you talking about I have to purchase two different types of insurance, or does my malpractice cover both
So they're very, very different and very important to understand. So occurrence-based insurance means no matter when the event happened, you will have been covered. So let's say this event happened in 2013 and you've changed two practices since then, but when you did the actual occurrence in 2013 and your group had occurrence-based, that's when it would have been covered. So that's very important for any individual that is moving around in their career component. Occurrence-based insurance is very expensive. So in the private world, it tends not to exist. A lot also depends on your state laws. So let's not forget, this isn't something that is legislative nationwide. It really is very much statewide. So in certain states, and I'll use Illinois as a prime example, in Illinois, I don't know of anybody who has occurrence-based insurance anymore as an independent because it's so expensive. Mm-hmm. The other type of insurance is called claims made, and it's exactly what it refers to. It means that the day the claim is made, you have to have insurance. So even if the event happened a year or two ago, it goes under the insurance policy that the claim was made under. Mm-hmm. So if you sort of think about it, occurrence, when it occurred, claims, when it was actually filed. So that helps us sort of keep it in mind. And it becomes real important with this thing called tail. Do you think our physicians understand what tail insurance is?
Well, you and I were speaking last night. You actually gave me some information that I had not thought about. Tell me what you mean by tail insurance.
So I always tell, like, specifically our fellows, because that tends to be where this starts to happen. But for all of our physicians, you must know your contract as it relates to your tail insurance, because it is very important, especially if you're in a claims-based insurance policy. So a tail policy would cover you. If I leave today and a claim is filed 3 weeks from now, I'm not going to be covered. It's called bare. I'm going to be bare. And that's not what you want to do. You do not want to have to pay for legal costs and attorney costs on your own. So tail, just think of a horse. We have heads and tails. So tail would be looking backwards. So whenever you leave, you want to make sure that you are covered. Either you purchase your own tail or your new facility purchase a tail. So very, very important.
You know, in the old days, meaning 30 years ago, a cardiologist would tend to stay in the same practice till they retire. But now we see people moving from not only practice to practice in the same state, but from state to state. So you're telling me I need tail insurance if I leave any practice and go to another one. Is that correct?
That's correct. And even in retirement. And I always caution our physicians about retirement. Many of our physicians want to go to wellness clinics or do some charity work. Who's going to cover you? Now, you always want to assume that nobody's going to sue you for doing the right thing and doing charity work. That would seem to be common sense, but that's not necessarily the case. Or curbside consults. I know physicians never do curbside consults. They never prescribe for family or friends. That would never happen. So think about that. So if you're retired, what can you really do? Now, some insurance companies in the state of Illinois, for instance, if you have been with their insurance company, it happens to be called ISMI, which is the Illinois state component, if you've been with them a certain amount of time, you get free retirement. But that's not true everywhere. So we couldn't possibly cover all the options on the podcast, but let's just make one point. If you're going to leave, make sure if you're going to do any type of practice that you have coverage.
Great lesson. I've actually written that down for myself, you know, that I need to check into tail coverage as I make transitions and do other things. You mentioned a few minutes ago different states, and I know that each state has its own laws. So you have also talked about capitated versus non-capitated states. So let's say I'm going to practice in California, and, you know, in California, there are lots of independent practices. What does it mean when you say a capitated state?
So our chapters of ACC have been very active in several states, and we refer to it as a cap state or an economic cap state, meaning that damages can't go beyond a certain dollar amount. So think about that. If you're in a state with an economic cap, your medical malpractice insurance costs are going to be much less than a non-cap state. So with Wisconsin, Indiana, Texas, we can't possibly go through all the states, but it's important that you know whether or not your state is got a cap to it. So if you're at a $350,000 cap, obviously you're not going to need very expensive insurance because there's a cap to that component. So it is important to understand where your legal parts are. And I think we need to congratulate many of our chapters that have done a great job with their state advocacy, because there is another organization, a PAC organization that's called the Trial Attorneys. And you can imagine trial attorneys may not be quite in favor of having economic caps on medical malpractice. And we'll leave that to our audience to digest that in full, because I think it really is important.
So let's go back to a kind of almost like a case-based setting. Back in 1991, when I was in my second year of practice, a police officer came to my practice and left a subpoena. They called me out of the room with the patient to meet with the police officer. I had no idea what was going on. And of course, fortunately, nothing ever happened out of that. But the shock to my system to be handed a subpoena by a police officer in front of my nurses and with patients around everything, I probably didn't sleep for a month. And this was just something I never expected when I started practice. So tell me, what are the first three things you should do if that ever happens to you? Because you said a lot of subpoenas never turn into suits or things like
right.
that. But I should not have been as shocked and had as much pain as I did for that.
I had a brother who went through it, and it truly does make it very, very difficult for them. Our physicians take it so personally. So let's start with a preemptive before the subpoena even comes. Please, everybody out there in podcast land, make sure your assets are in a trust. Make sure that you have worked with an attorney to make sure your assets are protected in the case of a lawsuit. For the most part, our malpractice insurance will help, but you do not want a creditor going after your assets. So we'll do one of our top three is actually a preemptive to make sure that you've got some legal help in making sure your personal assets are protected, especially if you're in a two-physician marriage of some sort. So that would be number one. Number two is, we try not to make this personal. Sometimes plaintiff's attorneys like the shock value of going to your home and serving you, going to your practice and serving you. And I wish we could get away from that, but we can't. So all we can say is, please just take a deep breath and find your best administrator and hand the subpoena to them and let them help you through this process. If you are in independent practice, you probably have a corporate attorney. The very first thing you want to do is to abide by the subpoena and acknowledge it. Running away from it or putting it in the bottom desk drawer is not going to help. And then the last thing is to protect anything around it. You want to make sure that there is no damage to the medical record. You rarely, if ever, want to modify that medical record. If you ever, ever modify a medical record, pre-subpoena, post-subpoena, you must date and time it. You must date and time it. Trust me, if you haven't watched enough CSI movies, there is plenty of forensic auditing going around. They know exactly who's been in the EMR, what day and time they've been in the EMR. So make sure that you have not, we call it a destruction memo, that there is no destruction of any sort around that. And then just wait, because as Mike said, the reality is many of these just get dropped. They just don't evolve, but the emotional angst is really, really difficult. But let's talk for a second, Mike, about what needs to be in your contract, because there's really two key elements once you have a subpoena, and that is your choice of attorney and how that will all unfold. And I don't know what you think, but one of the big issues is consent to settle. Mm-hmm. Physicians like want to have consent to settle. Would you say that's true?
Absolutely. I think that you need to have discussed these issues in advance. This is part of group practice. It's part of academic practice. I think having somebody teach you about this and understanding about this is very important. Many of our listeners, Kathy, will be at academic centers. They don't even know what consent to settle means.
Yeah, consent to settle is one of my big issues. Most of you, if you really truly read your contract, probably have something in there related to that. In the independent world, having the consent to settle is almost a God-given right, because you're obviously working with your attorney. In our academic and employed, not so much, because what's happening in both our employed and academic models is many, many of the systems have gone to offshore trusts. So much of the malpractice is in a trust. Well, in order to do the trust, they have powers within that trust that have been granted to them from these large systems. Consent to settle is rare, if ever, given to a physician. So we do like to make sure that you're involved in the process, because for the most part, as many of us will know, cases will get dropped. The cost of deposing, the cost of a trial, all those issues. Once you get your expert witnessing and such in place, there may come a time and point that in your brain, in your medical brain, you want to fight it all the way to the end. But we have to realize that there's a jury, and juries are rarely made up of 12 physicians, much less 12 cardiologists that would really understand your lingo. They're made up of normal human beings where much of the lingo will just go right over their heads and they'll see the aftermath or the outcome of the patient. So it's important to understand why we settle.
All right, Kathy, I want to take you back a little bit. Let's say to our FITs and early careers who are looking at where are they going to go practice. You talked about independent practice and how critical it is in an independent practice to make sure the individual and the corporation are covered. So I get that. I'm going into an academic or an integrated practice. What do I need to ask before I go in there?
So I think number one is, do you participate in settlement discussions? Are you part of that process? That would be a key element, because I think that's really, in quotes, all we can ask for, is to really be part of that process. I think the other question you might want to ask is joint counsel. Can I have my own counsel, or is everything joint counsel, i.e. if it's the hospital and you, the hospital and four other physicians, is there one attorney representing all of those interests? Because that's really important. I think those are the two things. Can I participate in any settlement discussions prior to it happening? And what about my joint counsel rights or ability to ask for my own attorney? It's in your contract, so chances are you want to really make sure that you've looked at your contract.
Well, this is great, because what you've really told me are the critical elements I need to think about, not only when I'm interviewing, but looking to change practice.
I think that's really true, and I think probably the last thing we really want to make sure that our podcast listeners understand is, if there is a settlement that you are named in, or maybe it's a 50% to you, 50% to the hospital, or some split thereof, make sure that you understand that there's usually two reporting mechanisms, the National Practitioner Data Bank, and then your state will also have some rules and regulations. So if by chance there is a settlement and you had been named, do not ignore those two things. You have a very tight timeline, 30 days. Make sure you work with an experienced attorney to write that explanation, because this is your chance, especially if you didn't agree or if it was settled. And this is what all the hospitals will review prior to employment. Everybody queries the National Practitioner Data Bank. So those are probably the two things we need to make sure people understand to protect yourself.
All right, Kathy, one final thing. What is ACC doing to help me as a member, and where can I find out more information?
And so I do believe that there is a liability website with our relationship with the doctor's company. Also, many of your chapters have it on their website. It's lots of educational materials, suit reviews, looking at why people are suing, what is that really all about. And then in addition to ACC, find your administrator. They are a wealth of information for you. They can help you talk through your contract, explain to you how their trust works, because it will be different for everybody. But at least you know, because you don't want to learn this after you've been served. You really want to know it beforehand.
Well, that may have been the best advice you've given me in all of this, is that I need to go meet with my administrator, whether I'm in private practice, integrated practice, or in academics. Preparation is far more important than trying to scramble in the panic after something happens.
Correct. And how are our attorneys chosen? In independent practice, obviously we have a little bit more say about that, but critical question in academia, who chooses our attorneys?
Mm-hmm.
So you know, because you will get to know them very, very well. Usually in the hospital setting, they do like joint defense. So normally it will be that one attorney. But here comes the issue. Almost always when a case comes close to settlement, you will get a letter that explains that we're close to settlement and you may want a personal attorney to help in that negotiation. Mm-hmm. Because this is where sometimes the understanding may split a little bit, because obviously you're going to be careful about your assets, going back to our issue with the trust.
Right.
So I call it the CYA letter for obvious reasons. If you happen to get a CYA letter, do not panic, but find that administrator. That letter tends to scare people, but I have never had a physician get their own counsel. So make sure you understand what it's about.
Excellent. Well, Kathy, I can't thank you enough for really filling me in and teaching our members here on this podcast. And you have really shown us what we need to do next. And what we need to do next is find out more information. This is much better done in preparation and in knowing who to go to and where are your resources and what the ACC has done and what your practice and your hospital have done in advance so that you are well prepared to ask the right questions.
And I think we'll leave you with just two. Number one, understand if you have occurrence versus claims made insurance. And number two is, where is your rights? You know, from an attorney selection as well as a being involved in the settlement discussion. Just those two will probably put your mind at ease and you don't have to worry about a lot of the other elements. Unless you don't have a trust, then you can do that as well, too. But I think that should help our listeners, Mike. I think it's been a great podcast.
Yeah, and I actually wrote down a third, which was tail insurance. If you're leaving or going somewhere else, you've got to ask about tail insurance.
Negotiate it. Negotiate it before you sign that contract.
Make sure that you know about it. And even for these fellows who are leaving, going into practice, are they covered when they leave that academic center or that community practice that they may have had a fellowship in as well?
Or if they've been moonlighting. Remember, every place you've been has probably had a malpractice, so you've got to make sure every place you've been from a clinical perspective.
Well, thank you all for joining us. We hope that this has been valuable. We hope that we have piqued your interest so that you too will learn more about your own medical liability risk and that you will learn more about how your coverage is and what you need to do now to be better protected and better cared for. Thank you, Kathy.
Thanks, everyone.
This is Dr. Allison Bailey, FACC. Thanks for joining us today, and please be sure to join us online at acc.org or on iTunes and Google Play to subscribe to Practice Made Perfect. We hope you'll join us next time as we continue our series and keep the conversation going on our new online community, Member Hub, to discuss these topics and any top-of-mind practice issues. Catch you next time to discuss more on how practice really does make perfect.